from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this next hour of Forum, San Francisco's Exploratorium Science Museum opens its doors at its new location at Pier 15 on the Embarcadero tomorrow. With three times more space, the Exploratorium will expand its exhibits outdoors into the city and bay. We'll get a preview of the revamped museum in the hour ahead. Join us for another hour of Forum all about the new Exploratorium after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of the Forum program. A global leader in informal learning and the world's most experimental museum, the Exploratorium opens its doors tomorrow on San Francisco's waterfront at Pier 15 with three times the space overall than its previous home, 150 new exhibits, an expansion into the bay, the city, and the outdoor landscape. The 330,000-square-foot indoor-outdoor project is being designed and constructed as the largest net-zero energy museum. And this Forum Hour, we explore the new Exploratorium. And I want to say right off that sometimes it's difficult, admittedly, for me to talk about 1 hour or something like the Boston Marathon and the terrible tragedy there and then go into something that I'm really jazzed about, like the Exploratorium. But it is what we do, and sometimes it's almost necessary because we could be, listeners, I think, want to hear about some joyful things as well. And I went through a tour last night, and this is something really to experience. This is a real gift to San Francisco and to people all over the world. We're going to talk about it and what it has in store for you. Dr. Dennis Bartels is with us. He is Executive Director of Exploratorium. Good morning, Dennis.
Thank you, Michael.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Susan Schwarzenberg, who is Senior Artist at the Exploratorium. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Good to have you here. And Rob Semper, Executive Associate Director and Director of Program at the Exploratorium.
Good morning.
And good morning, Rob, who was gracious enough to take me around yesterday and show me all the terrific things there. Let me begin, if I may, Dennis, with you, though. It's at its core, it's pretty much the same, people ought to realize. But it's bigger and it's better and it's more accessible.
Absolutely. I mean, we're just so unbelievably excited to open our new home tomorrow at 10 o'clock to the public. For 44 years, we've lived in that beautiful Palace of Fine Arts over there in the Marina neighborhood. But it was always a little bit dark and a little bit dusty and certainly isolated in many ways. We had lost our parking over there. And we needed to look out for a future, and we just could not have found a better place with more accessibility within 10 minutes of every major transportation system than those piers, piers 15 and 17 on the front porch of San Francisco.
It's a great location, great urban location, and I was cheered by the fact that you still have the Tactile Dome intact and lots of other things, as I said, that really have become such popular exhibits for Let's get this straight out. I'm not only talking about for kids here. I mean, there's no distinction really between what adults get out of this and what kids get out of this.
No. In fact, one of the surprises people don't know is our audience traditionally has been 60% adults and half of them without children in the old place. And we expect that number just to, grow at our new one. But it shouldn't surprise people that it really does have that same character and flavor and patina. I mean, that was one thing I think we were ourselves most worried about. But when you think about it, it was the same people who for 44 years have been prototyping that old Palace of Fine Arts that built the new place. And so we should have all known better. It really is got that very spirit that I think Frank helped get the place started with 44 years ago.
Yeah, let's talk about Frank Oppenheim, Rob Semper, because there's so much of him in this and so much of the history is tied to him.
Yes, Frank Oppenheim was an amazing person, a physicist. He worked on the atomic bomb project with J. Robert. Then he got caught up in the MacArthur era period, so he lost his teaching position, became a cattle rancher in Colorado, started teaching high school in a town in southwestern Colorado, and in a sense got rediscovered because all the science fair winners from Colorado started to come from this little tiny town in the mountains of Colorado. When he got rediscovered and back at the university level, he decided he didn't want to do any more scientific research, and he got really engaged in science education. He began working on curriculum, high school and then elementary science curriculum. But he had really enjoyed museums. He grew up in New York and felt that maybe he could create a public space where the public could really engage with exhibitry, could learn about the natural world by just playing themselves with these exhibits.
Color, smell, and sound.
That's right. He started with very, very basic things, really out of the elementary curriculum, color and sound and light, and created a set of exhibits that really started to explore the kinds of things we see every day. The secret was he married that with perception. So it wasn't just color and light. It was actually vision and seeing or hearing and sound. And he sort of stretched the exhibitry beyond the normal science curriculum into something that really grabbed people in an everyday way.
And we're still stretching. I mean, building air, land, and water exhibits with this great location outdoors as well, and stretching even to the point where well, not only biological sciences as well as the physical sciences, but we're into behavioral science and moving in all sorts of directions. And we'll find out from Susan Schwarzenberg about all the artistic sides of this. I mean, it's a cornucopia of all kinds of wonders and joys. And the fact of the matter is, you mentioned education. You got all these classrooms now. And I want to mention also that you got young high school kids who are going to be doing a lot of the explaining, which is great. Many of them from the Bayview in Oakland.
That's right. Yeah, the Exploratorium, I like to say it's evolutionary, not revolutionary. So there's a lot of old favorite, not only exhibits, but programs going on. Our high school explainer program, which is got invented at the Exploratorium really in the early days, right after the museum opened, has now stretched to programs all over the world that have emulated it. That program has expanded from having only 100 kids a year to now 300 kids a year working at the Exploratorium. They get to teach as well as learn, and it's just a marvelous experience for these kids, as many post-explainers can attest to. And the facility is really designed not only to support visitors, public visitors, but to really support the education of educators, teachers in the school system, teachers in the out-of-school system. We try to make use of the exhibitry and the space and the classrooms to really help create educators for tomorrow's educational issues.
You know, that's a great point about the explainer programs. It also illustrates the location move. The 100 kids we've had a year, it turns out 22% historically have come from District 10 here in San Francisco, which is the Bayview, Hunters Point. But you would find out that it took them about an hour, 15 hour, 20 minutes to get to work every single day. And by moving down to Piers 15 and 17, and not only do those kids tell me it'll take about 20 minutes, 25 minutes to come to work, but we open ourselves up also to all the teenagers in Oakland and the East Bay who can now find a way to come to the Exploratorium, whereas before it was almost impossible for a kid from Oakland to work at the Exploratorium.
Well, I'm going to have you and Rob describe for us some of the exhibits, but before I do that, Susan Schwarzenberg, let me bring you into this, because a lot of people don't even associate the Exploratorium with art, but it's playing a central role.
Yes. Ever since the beginning of the Exploratorium, we've had an artist-in-residence program.
You've been part of it 20 years now,
I think? I've been there for 30 years.
Oh.
It's 40-something.
You started when you were about 5 or 6.
Yeah, well, not quite, but... But as a young art student, I was trying to figure out what to do. What kind of job can an artist do? And I stumbled into the Exploratorium, and it was almost like being back in school again, in art school again. There was a shop that exhibits were being built all the time. There were artists coming in from the Art Institute and elsewhere. And in the evenings, it was kind of like having a big critique about art. So it was... So Frank hired Peter Richards, who he knew from Colorado, as the first director of the Artist in Residence program. People know Pete as the designer of the wave organ that's down there. We left that behind at the marina. And that program has been very robust throughout the years. We've brought in hundreds of artists who build exhibits, and the program has expanded now to something we're calling the Center for Art and Inquiry. And we've realized that artists come, and sometimes they don't develop an exhibit, but they influence us. They become thinking partners. And so we want to substantiate that really in a program that immerses us with great thinkers. So artists come, and sometimes they do research. They partner with us on ideas. And with this new center, we're really, I think, expanding that program to be even more robust. And we're opening with 40, I think, new art exhibits. So.
Well, you've got, in fact, everybody associates Exploratorium appropriately with interactivity, but I saw that map room that you had a lot to do with, and
yes.
I think it was described to me by Rob as a place for contemplation, but you've got maps that go back to like 1840.
Yes, yes. Well, my area is the observatory. It's the second floor of a glass box, basically, at the end of Pier 15. We have these glorious views of the downtown San Francisco and on the other side of the room, the bay. And in some ways, people who work at the Exploratorium, I like to think of us as gifted amateurs or something. You know, we explore topics many of us have never learned in our backgrounds. And oddly, may seem oddly to people, we didn't realize at first how important maps would be to understanding the landscape, since none of us studied geography. But we discovered it quickly. And we have over 50 maps that we've printed on a very strong substance Tyvek that people can look through from the 1850s to, we have artists now making maps for us. So we have this great variety of maps. And what's interesting about them is they're really interpretations about the landscape. Some of them are very accurate, and some of them are really more about cultural attitudes about the landscape, people's relationship to the place they live in. One is a language map of Native American groups who lived in the Bay Area in the 1830s and earlier.
And we should mention also that there's research going on. I mean, Rob, let me go to you on this. This is Wired Pier, which is really a research station for the environment.
Yes, that's right. One of the great opportunities with this relocation is we now are in a wonderful space with windows, with an outdoors that we can access. And we've actually become a node for research on the environment at that particular location. We have a partnership with NOAA, who study the environment all over the U.S. and all over the world. They're providing some instruments for us, and we have instruments from other Bay Area research groups to actually measure the air, measure the water, and the public can actually both see the instruments and see the results of the data coming from these instruments. So we've talked about it really as a wired pier, a place that the pier is actually instrumented to tell us what's happening at that particular location. And people will be able to see the data and also see the interpretation of the data in the observatory that Susan just talked about.
And let's also sound like I'm doing PR for you. Maybe I am, because I'm pretty excited about this, Dennis Bartels. I mean, we're down to almost putting no carbon footprint in this new facility.
Well, that's right. We work with a terrific architect, Mark Letalian, at EHDD, and they really wanted to bring out all the environmental chops in this particular design. And so they the goal is to be net energy zero. It's pretty ambitious, but we have a 1.3 megawatt power plant through the photovoltaic panels on our roof. And we're within a couple percentage points on the load side. So we did a number of different things, such as a bay water heating and cooling system, which uses the bay water, the ambient temperature of the bay, to actually both get our heat and our cooling needs. So there's no active air conditioning or heating system other than that on the site, as well as a number of other high-efficiency lighting and other sort of 44 different sustainability approaches to it, even all the way down to every drop of water that hits the pier goes into these two huge million-gallon cisterns that we use for both our gray water system and also what we don't need filter and put back into the bay. So it's an ambitious goal. I think, honestly, whether we reach it or not, it's more the demonstration and the all the things we need to do actually on the behavioral side that'll help us get there or not. And so it's one of our grandest experiments, actually, with this move. We'll see what the data tell us.
Well, all this excitement has been generated, and there's going to be a pretty mad rush. It's going to be, well, I think the word has been used as insane until maybe after Labor Day.
Well, one of the things I love about this site is that we have 2 acres of outdoor. We've been dying to play with Mother Nature herself directly for 44 years. We've been shrinking her to tabletop and bringing her indoors. But here we get to play with the wind and the tides and all the natural elements. But what's most glorious of all for us, it's a 9-acre campus. 3/4 of it will be free and open to the public 24/7. But we'll still have exploratorium exhibits and explainer carts and demonstrations. So whereas we may see a million or more people ticketed coming into Pier 15, we may see 4, 5, 6 million people a year coming onto our campus and experiencing the exploratorium for free.
Well, they can all experience it on the internet now, too. I mean, it's global and has an amazingly large global audience.
That's right. We found that we got onto the internet very early, back in 1993, and learned that we could use the same techniques we use for building museum exhibits and designing a museum to make a wonderful website. And that really took off in the 90s and through the after the turn of the century. What we try to do online is produce activities and experiences that are sort of the same in some respect as what you get when you physically visit. So our website is really designed to be an educational opportunity for people all over the world to experience what we do. We do webcasts from different places, present scientific discovery that's happening around the world, and really try to expand the audience of the Exploratorium to a worldwide audience.
And Susan, can I ask you to talk maybe some more about the outdoor exhibits, particularly the fog sculpture?
Yeah, the fog sculpture is a project of an artist who's been working with us for the past year or so to engineer this project. She's built them around the world. Her name is Nakaya.
Yeah,
Nakaya. Yeah, right. I'm sorry, I've forgotten her name for a moment there, but she originally was in. Her father is a scientist as well, so she's built these fog sculptures around the world. And we have a bridge that connects piers 15 and 17 and crosses the water. And out of the bridge will be this glorious sculpture that will turn on and off throughout the day. We're still trying to understand the sequence. But from the observatory, of course, we have fog coming in from the bay, and then we have our own fog we're creating out the other side of the window. So it really stops people, arrests them with this beautiful, spumes of fog, which, you know, you can explore through really the way the wind works.
I think Fujiko Nakaya.
She was actually an artist who started with the EAT program. Some of you in the Bay Area may remember the EAT program, Experiments in Art and Technology, which was sort of the big rage in the end of the 60s and early 70s. She started her first fog project back in the late 60s and actually worked with scientists at JPL to develop fog nozzles that would actually atomize fog in a very, very specific way. Those fog nozzles now have become part of cooling systems for server farms and also for keeping orchards from freezing. And so her bringing this piece back to the Bay Area is sort of like a full circle for us.
Well, and yet, I mean, some people are going to enjoy the exhibits they went to when they were younger and went to with their kids and the kids who are now adults and so forth, because, as I've said, but there are about 150 new exhibits, and one of these that is particularly compelling is the plankton exhibit. Let's talk about that, Dennis.
Well, the plankton exhibit we had to ask ourselves a really important question, which is, we're over the water. So what's our contribution to the ocean narrative, the bay, given that there's so many wonderful institutions like the Cal Academy and Monterey Bay Aquarium that already do great conservation science at the human scale, you know, mammals and fish that you can see. And what our team discovered is it was really our traditional strength in microscopy, one of the leading institutions of our kind in terms of sort of single cell life, that was the answer to that question, which is, what about the microbial environment in the oceans, which in turn actually is the most important starting point for all of life on Earth, including that on the terrestrial side. And oh, by the way, it's where a lot of leading science is heading, whether it's energy science or pharmaceutical science, medical science. Craig Vittner's out there trying to sequence all the known single cell life in the oceans right now. He's convinced that the...
As we speak, probably.
Yeah, probably as we speak. So one of the new exhibits, which is really a beautiful display table, highly interactive, where you put your own lens scope any place on the global map, and it'll actually show you in real time the plankton, the zooplankton that happened to exist right there at that moment in these different regions, and how they're traveling around the world, and where sort of plankton growth and outbreaks happen, where it actually sort of disappears and becomes more of a desert, and how active and dynamic that those single cell critters are with the entire oceans and atmospheric systems. It's sort of that systems view that I think we need to really start to comprehend these very complex problems we're all facing today.
And Rob, who has been on with us before on Forum talking about science education, this is a lot of what this is all about, took me to this two-faced mirror that I'm still trying to get out of my consciousness on the one and exorcise if I can. Talk about that. I mean, just how that works, because
right.
It's fascinating.
So this is a two-faced mirror. This is an exhibit that's in the news section where we're really looking at human behavior and human social interaction. And it's an exhibit that actually takes your picture of your face and then replicates one side to the other, so it actually makes two versions of your face as if it was symmetrical. So it takes the left part of your face and mirrors it into the right, and the right side of your face and mirrors it into the left. And so you see your face in quite a different way. It's actually symmetrical. And what you quickly learn is two things. One is most people's faces are not symmetrical. In fact, when you look at them, the part of the interest, I think, about people and their humanness, if you want, is the fact that their face has so much character in it. So rarely do the two sides of the faces look the same, and you really get to study face and facial structure. It's an important part about human behavior because actually just facial recognition is such an amazing part of our human nature. Babies learn to recognize faces almost immediately. And so here this really stimulates you to think about your face and think about other people's faces and how you actually look and notice people's features.
And Susan, let's talk about, you mentioned, I think, some of your favorite exhibits outside of the artistic realm that you move in. What are they?
Well, I'm so immersed right now in the work of the observatory that there's one exhibit that has been my biggest headache, but also I'm most proud of and is now my favorite. And this is this is one we call Visualizing the Bay. And you may have seen it last night.
I did,
It's a topographic map of the Bay Area that we carved in the shop with a CNC router, using digital data to create this topography of the Bay Area, as well as bathymetry, which is the landscape underneath the bay and the ocean. And on it, we project different data sets. We have a fog model that we project onto this platform that we worked on with scientists from the National Weather Service in Monterey, our NOAA partners. We have a salinity model where you see that the bay and ocean are really a pumping mechanism where daily, with the tides, salt water is brought into the bay and then pushed out by fresh water.
This way, it tastes different salt water.
Well, there is another
exhibit.
There's another exhibit that the outdoor group is doing that allows you to taste the different salinity levels in the bay at different points.
And up there in that observatory, I observed. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a place where you go in and you actually look up and you see the sky.
Yes, that's we think of that entire observatory as an instrument in and of itself. We call that the oculus, and a spot of light. It was engineered to project a spot of light on the floor to maximize the potential of that throughout the day. And this spot moves, and we're developing with an artist and an astronomer team a kind of a sundial that you can move with it, so you can use that to sort of see time inside the room.
Well, you learn a lot about our own environment. I mean, not only outdoors but indoors. I was looking at, we've got something with the 360 days,
right,
and mm-hmm. you see how clear. I mean, it's surprising
right.
how
well,
clear so many of those days are.
It's really right. I love that mm-hmm. piece. It shows you all 365 days looking up at the same spot in the sky, actually over our old palace home from the last year.
Is it all 365 or is it just 360?
It's 360 when we
yeah. count. Oh, you
it has
the math.
To be rectangular.
Okay, well then we're missing 5 days on that chart, but when you look,
I asked about leap
right.
year.
But when you look at it, what's so glorious is you see two very distinct lines where it's mostly blue, and then one distinct line where it's sort of gray and dark gray, and another line where it's kind of gray whitish. And what you really realize is you're looking at the fall, the winter, the spring, and the summer in real time, and you really get to see how many clear days there really are in San Francisco. The sort of inside joke is we should actually also on those same boxes put the number of people who showed up, because there's always myth or theory or who knows if it's true, but we can now test whether more people show up on rainy days than on sunny days.
So, and this is a project made by an artist, I should say, Ken Murphy, and we love that piece so much. He's now doing a whole series of time-lapse studies in the museum for
yeah,
us.
Yeah, a former worker here at KQED.
Yes,
exactly.
Oh, no kidding. That's right.
San Francisco's Exploratorium Science Museum opens its doors at its new location tomorrow, and if you have questions or comments, remembrances of the Exploratorium, or looking toward the future of the Exploratorium, feel free to join us. Our toll-free number is available now. It's 866-733-6786. We can talk about science education, too. But feel free to join the program at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. A great deal of excitement over San Francisco's Exploratorium Science Museum opening its doors at its new location tomorrow. That's at Pier 15 on the Embarcadero, and with three times more space, The Exploratorium will expand its exhibits outdoors into the city and the bay. We're talking about really what's there and previewing it. And the revamped museum is something that I know many of you are excited throughout the Bay Area and Northern California about, and an opportunity for you to talk with those who are centrally, in many ways, providing the leadership. Dr. Dennis Bartels with us is Executive Director of Exploratorium, and Rob Semper is Executive Associate Director and Director of Programs for the Exploratorium, and Susan Schwarzenberg is Senior Artist with the Exploratorium. Number of ways you can join the program if you have some questions or comments or just some of what you want to describe as your own anticipation of the Exploratorium. And I know there are a number of people who have seen private shows, and you may want to join in here too. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. And a couple other ways you can communicate if you want to, and we certainly welcome your voices in this conversation and discussion about the new Exploratorium. You can go to our Facebook page, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Let me go to your calls, and let's begin, Nick, with you. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Okay.
Good. I was just wondering if any of your guests knew what was going to be happening with the old Exploratorium building?
Yes. This
Dennis Bartels.
Yes. Thank you, Michael. This is a frequently asked question, and it's terrific. It is such a beloved site and lovely grounds. And in the short run, it'll actually be occupied by the town school, which needed a temporary campus while they fix up their original one. And indeed, they asked us to leave most of the infrastructure in the building itself because they figured it was perfect setup for them. Everything from the central gallery being a playground all the way to the Ames Distortion Room being a fun place for kids to play, as well as all the classroom spaces. And so we couldn't have imagined in the short run a better use for it than an educational one, and we're really happy when we heard the town school was coming in. Longer term, the city Rec and Park Department is the landlord, and I believe they're running a process and soliciting proposals for what will come in after a year to occupy that site.
Well, Susan Schwarzenberg, didn't you talk about this as a kind of incubation space, an old dark place?
Yeah, we like to, I mean, it had no windows, so we were left alone. I think it was Frank's great hidden experiment for a while that we were there just, and so I can see the kids at the school treating it the same way. Great playground for growing up.
Well, a practical question, if I may, Rob Semper. I know you guys raised a lot of money and did very well on that side of things, and a lot of generous support and a lot of people to be thankful for and feel grateful. But this could have a lot of upkeep expense too, isn't it?
Sure. This is an interesting building. I used to joke that our air conditioning in the old building was a hole in the roof, which it really was. And now we have these elaborate systems to operate and maintain. And it's a fairly sophisticated building. Every outlet and every light is controlled by a computer, partially to keep this net energy zero goal that Dennis mentioned. So we've taken the building on. We've learned what it will take to operate. We're actually going to be probably for the next year figuring out how all of the parts work and how to make it work. But it is more elaborate setup, and hopefully the we're up to the task. We think we are to maintain this building, and we're going to just learn as we go this year.
And I'm going to read some emails here. Here's Laura, who writes, a wonderful book to recommend to listeners about Frank Oppenheimer and the Exploratorium is Something Incredibly Wonderful Happens. It's a wonderful read about Frank's life and how dedicated and passionate he was about creating the Exploratorium in San Francisco. It's truly inspiring and incredibly insightful into the creation of a really magical and special place. You often do hear that word magical, and it's fascinating to read about Frank Oppenheimer, certainly. I can't get him out of my head on the riding horses because you put that in there, Rob. Here's Teresa, who asks on Facebook, will they still offer a free day once a month to residents?
So the free day, in fact, we will be providing more access free of charge to the community. Again, given our location, it's a terrific thing. But we're going to try a little different experiment. We're actually going to go with quirky days for our free days. So indeed, Groundhog Day and Pi Day are among them, as well as more traditional free days such as Mother's Day and
Founders
Day. So
what is Pi Day? Is that something from Pythagoras or
Rob?
What is Pi Day? Baking pies?
Pi Day was a creation actually by the Exploratorium, by a staff member of the Exploratorium who was sitting around realizing that 3.14, March 14th, was a perfect day to celebrate pie.
So it is Pythagoras.
It is Pythagoras, that's right. And sometimes we throw in some fruit pies as well. It's turned out to be now a worldwide celebration all over the world when people celebrate that day. I think it's great to have a day for this kind of Greek character that kids sort of learn in school, and it's sort of almost a cartoon character in a way.
Yeah. Here's a listener and getting questions, of course, about costs. And this listener, Chris, says, when the city rebuilt the old Steinhardt Aquarium, they jacked the fees way up. I hope that isn't going to happen at the new Exploratorium.
Well, the listener would be pleased that, in fact, we brought over the fee structure from the Palace of Fine Arts, and so it remains the same. Thing that we're trying that's new and different, which I really encourage all of our local listeners to take advantage of, is any resident in the Nine-County Bay Area will automatically receive a discount when they come to the Exploratorium. So the adult price is $25. The discount price will be $5 off for our local community. We are doubling the size of our free access program and also have the free outdoor space. But I think most importantly, we have one of the lowest average ticket prices in the country for our industry, which means we do more free and subsidized ticketing for those who truly need that opportunity to come to the Exploratorium. So we take this accessibility not just as a location charge, but also as one in which we really can work with very specific community organizations and neighborhoods and the public library system to make sure that price is never a barrier for enjoying the opportunity to visit the Exploratorium.
And speaking on that same motif, there's a listener who wants to know about public transportation from the East Bay because parking is going to be difficult.
Yes. So this is really important. A couple of messages I did want to get out. One is, of course, in our first few months till Labor Day, to please, if you would, reserve your tickets online. We do expect some crowds and capacity challenges at the new site, but also to encourage everybody who can to come by public transportation. We do have parking directly across the street and some overflow parking in Levi Plaza and the Embarcadero parking lots. But if we could do what we did with the San Francisco Giants, and in particular being a 10-minute walk from the Embarcadero BART station, being right on the F line, which is the trolley line, being 10 minutes from the ferry building, and being right there close to the Muni system and bus system, that we would love it if most people came, in fact, by public transportation. And thus far in our previews, we've seen, in fact, an extraordinary number coming by public transportation and not even filling the parking lot across the street.
And again, Dr. Dennis Bartels is executive director of the Exploratorium. Mark writes, can your guests talk about the tension between designing exhibits for the transfer of information versus creating a chance for people to ask and explore their own questions? It's not just one or the other, I think. Mm-hmm. Susan Schwartz?
Yeah. Well, I think all of our exhibits start out as prototypes. They start out as experiments, really. Usually they're driven by a question the staff has, sometimes an interesting phenomena an individual has discovered, and they create a kind of a prototype for this. They put it on the floor. The public starts using it, and they learn from that, and they change the exhibit according to how it's used. Perhaps they extend it. Sometimes people write to us with great ideas, and we bring them in to work with us, or we take their idea and see what we can do with it. So,
well, for example, I'm thinking of an exhibit last night when I was there where you put your hand on one pipe, and it's cold, and another pipe, and it's warm, and then you put your hand on the pipe in between, and I mean, that must have just been cooked up by somebody saying, this is an idea whose time has come in terms of an exhibit. Yeah.
That's right. I mean, there's sort of a method to this madness. I mean, each exhibit level, it's something interesting. Like that exhibit really shows you the interesting things that happen with sense of touch and the sense of feeling temperature and how you can actually confuse your sense of touch. It's actually like a touch illusion, just like an optical illusion. But it's important to note that these exhibits are in sort of an exhibit curriculum. So there's many more exhibits on touch than just that one. And so the way we sort of balance this question that the listener sent in is that we believe that having a variety of different examples of something like touch or like resonance is one way to build up the infrastructure for learning that allows people to then extend their learning beyond, say, having this physical experience and getting more technical or more abstract about it. I like to think that the Exploratorium is really about the idea of engagement. Frank Oppenheimer really believed that to learn something, you actually should be interested in it in the first place. And so having things that are interesting to different people is probably the foundation to the educational experience at the Exploratorium.
And Rob Semper is Executive Associate Director and Director of Programming for the Exploratorium. And Corey writes, any exhibits or activities for toddlers?
So the Exploratorium, I think, really works for people of all ages. It doesn't have in this particular in our venue a specific place for very young kids, but we found that the kids love to play at that age with things like the colored shadow wall or with the shadow exhibits and some of the other motion exhibits. And we really find that kids of all ages can really have a great time at the Exploratorium, including kids of all ages up to the age of 95 or 100, by the way.
But you can confuse the real little kids by if they're going through toilet training, because you got that toilet there that's a water fountain still from the old place, right?
Exactly. You can't imagine the amount of fun the kids have going to that when they discover it and kind of joking with their parents about taking a drink from this. I mean, they just are enlivened by that exhibit.
Thomas asks, although the physical aspect of the Exploratorium is obviously their focus, there is such a potential to increase their reach online. Why have they neglected the online realm so strongly? Well, the answer is you haven't neglected it.
Right. I think the Exploratorium website, for example, reaches about 15 million people annually. And we spend a lot of time trying to understand how to make interactive exhibits work online. We've now moved into the app world. We have two apps on the tablets, one on sound and one on light, that are really amazing. I encourage our visitors to sort of see those as well. And we really are expanding our work into social media as well as a lot of other institutions. It turns out that it's interesting to understand what works really well online and what doesn't. And we spend a lot of our time trying to do research and development to really explore the online world with interactivity.
Lots more emails, but let me go to some more of your calls. And let's go to Berkeley. Chan, good morning.
Good morning. As a minor contributor to the Exploratorium's move, I've seen a few sneak peeks, and I've been delighted. I must say, gratitude and admiration both to you folks for preserving some indescribable magic of the place. I think Frank Oppenheimer would be delighted. It's early days, though, and there are still a few kinks, and I just wanted to mention a few of them. I was there with some friends who had an 18-month-old boy who, by the way, loves the Exploratorium. He calls it the Ploratorium. And for him, the moment began the moment we went in the door. In the entrance lobby, you have a beautiful modernist sort of couch/bench, red fabric, has a little bump in it as a back, and he immediately started climbing on that and sliding down, exploring the piece. An older patron came along and had a fit that he was doing this, and had the piece, in fact, been in the De Young or someplace like that, it would have been inappropriate. But I think your attendees and signage, et cetera, ought to make it clear that this is a hands-on exploring experience, and it begins at the door. Secondly, the restaurant. The original Lion Street site had basically a glorified hot dog stand, and I was very impressed with the new restaurant. I went in there, saw a sushi chef standing there making food to order, had a marvelous meal that was good value for money, but it wasn't cheap, and I'm a little concerned that this may not be optimal for kids and young families. And my final concern, I understand that you've tripled your paid staff. I just hope and pray that you've got a good financial footing to keep it all going, because this place is really not just a San Francisco treasure, but a world treasure. Mm-hmm. Thanks for everything you've done.
Hey, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Well, terrific, terrific questions. I mean, to his first points, the funny thing about the prototyping culture of the Exploratorium is it always required visitors and users to finish the product. We've really respected that culture for 44 years. For 100 days, we had to close, and we've been putting everything out. And the one thing we've been missing is visitors. So one reason why we ran so many previews as we did is to discover exactly these types of behaviors and incidences.
So what are you going to do about that couch?
Well, I think I'll let Rob and Susan answer that question. But I'll talk about the tree, because that's another one that people have talked about, including a couple of our very donors and board members. We have a big, giant 330-year-old Douglas fir in the back. And one of our board members, some of you may know, Mickey Hart, actually saw the tree there, and he was in a panic because he touched it and the bark crumbled off. And he was really upset. He felt like, oh, my gosh, this will be a disaster. There'll be bark all over the floor, and we didn't seal the tree properly. And Mickey, I hope you forgive me for telling this story, because you were laughing at it the other night. But we had to sort of let Mickey know that, no, we are the place of hands-on. And in fact, that tree is there to touch and to feel and to even scrape a little bark off. That the whole idea of that tree is, in fact, to watch it rot in front of your eyes the next 10 years. And so it absolutely is the house of hands-on.
Did you notice when you're in the green room, there's a wall with signatures all over it? Mickey Hart says, Michael, I didn't inhale.
He's a terrific board member. We love it and love having artists at every level in the organization, and including the board. But we are – one of the nice things Frank said is the Exploratorium will never be done. And even in this move, we are nowhere – we will never be complete. We will never be finished. And we really do need now visitors to activate the space and to see all the ways that it works and doesn't work, to adjust signage. Indeed, that front hall that he's speaking of where that red chair is was just there in the short run to be, frankly, an open lobby for overflow capacity. And we haven't truly exploratoryized it yet that we plan to. But it's good to get this type of feedback. It's the very kind of thing that I think even our most closest friends are really wonderful at their candor, and so is the staff, and then quickly adjusting because that visitor use, and in particular how creative in particular children are in finding all sorts of ways of using something you never intended it for, turns out to be one of the three most important criteria we have to decide what exhibits stay on the floor and which ones disappear back into the closet.
Talk, though, for a moment, if you would, about the restaurant. It looks like a world-class restaurant with a world-class chef, and it looks expensive, and probably is, like the caller said.
We are so pleased to have Loretta Keller, executive chef of Coco 500, as our executive chef in partnership with Uta Bose and with Fidel and Bon Appetit. And they have put together this amazing place at the end of the bay. That is not the only place for food on the site. In fact, they will be putting...
You have a hot dog stand?
We're going to have several food carts, hot dog stands, a liquid nitrogen ice cream cart, and a grab-and-go in the beginning, which will actually vary in the types of foods and the types of pricing, because we really do appreciate that. In fact, we're going to have people coming from all over the world, and we wanted to treat as wide a diversity and variety of taste. And I really know that Loretta and our partnership with the restaurant that we're all sort of in together, really getting a good sense of exactly what people are looking for.
And pies on pie day.
And pies on pie day.
Let me go back to a question I think that's always hovering over the Exploratorium and all the magic there and everything. How much science do kids actually learn, though, Rob? I mean, from the interactive exhibits like the ones we've been talking about. Is there any data on that, any research?
Yeah, so there's a couple ways to answer this question. We do actually do research on what people are doing at the Exploratorium. We have a whole research group that studies visitor learning in the place, where they go, what they're learning. The way I like to think about this is that, you know, learning happens in a lot of places. It happens in schools. It happens at home. It happens listening to media. It happens in museums. If you follow a kid's brain around, they're in all of these places. And learning is an active process that a person does. The role a place like the Exploratorium plays is it really works on the engagement end of learning, which is so critical and often sometimes missing, unfortunately, in some of the formal education systems. To be engaged, to be excited about learning turns out to be a critical part of the whole learning process and the learning progression. So I think it's important to say it's not just happening in school learning, but it's also not just happening in the Exploratorium. The other thing that happens very often in the Exploratorium is people don't usually come by themselves. They come with friends. They come with other folks. And there's an awful lot of teaching and learning that goes on at an exhibit between folks where someone knows something, they share that with someone else. The explainer may help you learn something. So that kind of learning, it's almost an intangible part of the learning process. It's actually, I think, foundational to the whole educational experience.
And talk about the explainers, too, because you've got these kids, many of them, as we said, from Bayview Hunters Point in Oakland, who are there. They're employed. They're paid. And there has been, I think, some results that are really quite striking in terms of how they go on and use that experience.
We've studied the explainers. The program's been going on since 1970, and we've done two longitudinal studies where we've gone back and actually interviewed ex-explainers. And what you find is an amazing thing that they all say to a point. It's not that they go into science. Of course, some people do, but most of our explainers don't necessarily go into science. They're not science whiz kids, et cetera. But they all say they took charge of their own education. They made some choices about their first year of college or where to go to college or what they were going to take. They made the choices that often, myself included, kind of drifting in the first few years of college, you sort of don't pay attention to. So because they had to be teachers at the exhibits, they began to think about learning in a much deeper way. And we're just so pleased that this program can exist. And we have so many folks tell us about their kids were explainers or they were explainers when they were young and how important that was to their lifelong experience.
Talking about the new Exploratorium, and let me go to more of your calls. David, join us. Hi.
Hi there. I went to the members preview, and I ended up spending almost all my time in the room with a very profound exhibit on mental illness. And that was in a context with a lot of ambitious new material about the social and social psychological and very adult issues. And I wonder how much that room is not only not particularly well-suited for young people, but represents a design decision that it's okay for the Exploratorium to tackle you know, issues like showing well-graffitied public signs, a nice model for our youth, and to talk about very unsettling issues of mental illness and the ambiguity, moral ambiguity of the authority of psychiatric institutions, and really very, very adult stuff.
It's a good point, David. I mean, you don't have adults only in that section.
Well, you know, it goes right back to Casey Cole's book, and I was so glad that got mentioned before, and Frank's own politic, that most people don't appreciate that the Exploratorium was started as a political institution, and that for Frank, it was what happened to him with the McCarthy era and losing his job in physics and being asked to name names, but it also goes back to his days at Los Alamos and letting the genie out of the bottle as it regarded the physics community and the atom bomb. And he really felt that this stuff was too important to future society to leave just in the hands of the politicians and scientists, that it belonged to all of us, and that we needed to think for ourselves. And so our recent push into the social sciences and human beings is both an extension of sort of human perception that Rob mentioned earlier, but gets us into some of these more difficult issues. If you look at some of the most pressing global problems in the next 20, 50, 100 years, almost all of them are very tightly wrapped up in science and technology and human values. And we wanted a way to enter into those conversations without being didactic about it.
Although there are those, of course, Rob and I were talking a little bit about this last night, who would say this is the soft science. This is, you know, not the hard sciences
like
physical and biological. And you got the whole DMS controversies and all that.
And people, so many people sort of miss that even in our old place, let alone, you know, that was built in. For Frank's era, it was the Cold War, clearly. But in our era, it's what is it that it means that we've now let the genome out of the bottle and that our grandkids could double their natural lifespans. That's quite theoretically possible now. And what does it mean to a world that we've got everybody living to 200? And so we needed a way to get into those conversations without resorting to marketing to kind of tell everybody what to think and do. This is a place where we want you to think and decide for yourselves and your families and your communities what to do. So looking at sort of the more deep and established analytical tools of the social sciences, be it the tragedy of the commons or game theory or prisoner's dilemma, we wanted exhibits and experiences that help people understand why the latest, you know, international fishery treaty just failed again.
And but you have recommended ages for, you know.
No, I think we really trust the intelligence of our users. We've never dumbed down anything. We've never tried to protect anybody from anything. We really believe that, in fact, you've got to be committed that people can make thoughtful decisions for themselves and for their families, even in walking through some place like the Exploratorium. And I think we want to hold to that point of view.
Another listener writes, I'm so excited to take my son to the new Exploratorium in his favorite part of San Francisco. I think he will love the exhibits, but we'll still have to wait a bit for the crowds to pass. My 9-year-old son is severely autistic, and the noise and sensory overload of big crowds is very difficult for him to handle. Other than waiting for months for the crowds to lessen somewhat, do you have any plans for programs for special needs children or special education services or field trips? There are a lot of kids with sensory sensitivities who could benefit, and I should probably also add, are there wheelchair access available?
Yeah, so we've always had extra programming for different kinds of visitors, different kinds of needs, and the summer is going to be pretty, we think, pretty busy. For one thing, America's Cup is happening a few piers down. We know it's going to be kind of a crowded space on the Embarcadero. But we have programs for field trips and for groups coming at different times when it's not sort of insanely busy. We're also very much looking at what times of the day the building will be actually more quiet for different kinds of groups. And in the past, in the old Exploratorium, we did have very special groups that could come in when it wasn't so hectic. I will also have to say, and people know this, when the old Exploratorium was really full of people, it was incredibly noisy. the new building, we took all of the things we learned in the last 44 years into the new building. We have modified somewhat, I think, the whole sound part of the building. So it's not quite as frenetic as it used to be. So I think look to the fall for a new program so let people come when it's not sort of jammed with visitors 24/7.
I think one of the great things about the additional space, too, that we've talked about is we used to have some famous user groups that would come in even after we were closed and use the facility. And one of those user groups actually was an autism group. We didn't have that sort of noise and access, and we really do have a lot more ability, including, by the way, being open Wednesday and Thursday nights. And although Thursday nights will be really programmed for young adults, Wednesday nights we really hope to see a lot more families, and we expect that it will be a little bit more quiet. So whether it's a user group or finding those times like in the evenings when we are going to be open, I think these are the very kinds of communities that we want to be able to expand our programming for simply because we have so much more space now.
Any thoughts about additional security, particularly in light of what happened in Boston and the kind of crowds we're going to be seeing?
Well, certainly we know that we've moved from kind of the park out in the marina to downtown San Francisco and on the Embarcadero, and it's not quite the same environment. We're planning to be as open, as accessible as possible. That's our goal, and we're going to try to make it work in that space without a lot of extra security. We certainly have our awareness up, and we sort of are learning the space just like everyone else, and we hope people will bear with us as we sort of adopt that space on the Embarcadero street line. You know, I think we are a public institution, and we expect the public to come and enjoy our place, both in the paid part and in the free part. And we're just going to have to be as vigilant as we can to make sure it's an environment that people find is safe and secure and welcoming. One other thing to say, and I should add about the adult exhibit. One of the things we really are looking forward to is being downtown, because we really think we can actually reach out to some of the adult community that's in the downtown area as much as we've reached out to families out in the Palace of Fine Arts in the past.
Well, congratulations, and ongoing, onward and upward. I mean, it is really something to see and something to experience, and thank you all for being here. Appreciate it. We've been talking with three people from the Exploratorium who are central in the new Exploratorium, which will be available to you, the public, beginning tomorrow. Dr. Dennis Bartels with us, Executive Director, and Susan Schwarzenberg, Senior Artist, and Rob Semper, Executive Associate Director and Director of Program. And we thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you. We are here with you every Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Talk about science. Mary Roach will be with us in this hour tomorrow. We're going to talk about her new book, Gulp, Adventures Along the Alimentary Canal. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and you can continue this conversation on our website. Go to kqed.org/forum and click on the segment, or on our Facebook page. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.